What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. You need at least a dozen guys doing a combination of cons.
Like what, do you think?
Well, off the top of my head, I'd say you're looking at a Boesky, a Jim Brown, a Miss Daisy, two Jethros, and Leon Spinks. Not to mention the biggest Ella Fitzgerald ever.
Geez, Michael, two Jethros and a Leon Spinks?
We're robbing three casinos, right?
No, we're just sharing our top five movie teams and reviewing the new X-Men film.
All right, Josh, we're going to star in our own reboot of the Ocean's 11 series, Ocean's 2.
That plus Michael's report from the Cannes Film Festival and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM514. You're listening to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips sitting in for Adam this week. I'm Josh Larson. Michael, it's good to have you back, or should I say bon de vous revoir. You were, after all, just at the Cannes Film Festival, right?
Were they? That's all they say over there.
You hear that a lot. Michael and I are going to put aside our petty differences for the good of humanity and the show when we share our top five movie teams. But first, our review of a movie that begins in the future, mostly takes place in the past, and has more mutants than Patrick Stewart can shake a stick at. Here's hoping Michael can help me find my way through X-Men Days of Future Past.
Mutants, we now find ourselves on the edge of extinction. You'll need to go into the past to end this war before it ever begins.
Use your power. Bring the X-Men together.
A confession here, Michael, and one that in the minds of some X-Men fans will probably disqualify me from even giving this review. But I've always found these X-Men films deflatingly average. Not necessarily bad. I've actually been mildly positive about most of them. But even those that I've enjoyed have quickly faded from my memory, lost in the mists of my movie-going experiences, like something conjured up by Halle Berry's Storm. The X-Men franchise has only seemed more average to me with the explosion of comic book movie adaptations since 2000's X-Men. In the wake of the likes of the first Spider-Man, I'm a Tobey Maguire guy, or Batman Begins, and above all, The Dark Knight, I've come to think of the X-Men installments as something like the IKEA of superhero movies. They'll do the trick until we can get some real furniture. What's been your take, though, on this series, Michael, especially compared to the countless other superhero sagas we've seen in the last 14 years? And in particular, did X-Men Days of Future Past distinguish itself in this landscape, or having just walked out of the theater literally minutes ago,
literally,
is it already fading in your memory too?
Well, the trick with this, Josh, is I saw this in the future, and then I went back briefly to 1973 to see it from that perspective.
And where did it play best?
I finished it up in early 2014. it's got the irresistible angle that doesn't really even owe its origins to superhero comics. It goes back to things like Dickens' Christmas Carol and other stories. And I think of that because Patrick Stewart has played in the most fantastic one-person version of Christmas Carol I ever saw on stage was with him. But the idea of your older self having heart-to-heart conversations with your younger self, and of course, this is a metaphysical kind of like fantastic concept that applies very nicely to this universe. And that's the whole crux of this, right? That we can have scenes between James McAvoy and Patrick Stewart, just kind of
as the same character.
Yes, dealing with each other, and that kind of provides the through line, the glue, I think, to what is a pretty decent installment in this picture. It's just sort of odd to me. The thing I can't get my mind around, Josh, and I wish I was more of an ardent fan of this series too, although I don't think it's ever been bad, and a couple of them in particular have been pretty good. This idea of having a kind of a rotating cast of all-stars that in many cases, like in the case of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, they get to anchor their own sub-franchise in this franchise. But here they're kind of just sort of sitting around functioning as, you know, plot functionaries, you know, filling in the cracks and doing the best they can with this material, while really the film is turned over, even with all these starry people in it. Jennifer Lawrence has a big part. Halle Berry, who's a little less box office, has a much smaller part. I mean, it's all very strategic, I think, rather than an artistic or creative decisions. But it's just a peculiar experience to see people kind of stars of their own franchises here kind of, you know, just doing the teamwork, you know, as to your theme this week. A lot of films in these superhero franchises, Josh, really don't depend on your memories of the previous one. And this one, I find, did. And coming off a plane, jet-lagged from France, and with this sort of melange of you know, you can't keep them straight without a scorecard, and yeah, maybe it's that I'm 53 years old, maybe it's a lot of things, but it is, in fact, a bit of a blur. A classy blur for what it is, but a bit of a blur.
So you're telling me you didn't watch the previous 5-6 X-Men
films on the plane
before seeing this?
No, well, I was catching up with Mad Men. Okay.
That's really all on you. No, it does raise an interesting question, though. What's our responsibility as viewers to refresh ourselves in those stories, in the backstories? And this applies to the Avengers franchise, which is even more sprawling now from Marvel as well.
Right.
What's our responsibility to do that homework if it's not fresh there in our minds, if we're not big enough fans to carry that with us always? And I'm not, as much affection as I have for a lot of these figures.
Right.
Is it our responsibility to do that homework, or is it the filmmaker's responsibility to weave that backstory, the mythology, into the new movie? Because, you know, to be fair to them, that can get repetitive as well.
Right.
Rereading
right.
some of the Harry Potter books right now, it's striking me how much time Rowling does spend in re-educating her readers. Now, for me, that's helpful because I'm not a Harry Potter fanatic,
right.
but I can see how it'd be tedious. So there's this balance that has to be struck. Now, as far as Days of Future Past, for me, I didn't do mega research either beyond reading my earlier reviews of the films. I wouldn't say I was lost, but I did feel like things were happening in a blur around me, and instead I latched onto the performances that I could, because this is an extremely overqualified cast. I would think that this hook you mentioned that got to you, or that you appreciated about your future self advising your younger self, that is something that's inherently compelling. But for me, in a movie that is so complicated with so many locations, so many characters and different backstories going on, time travel is the last thing I need to add to the balls I'm juggling.
Right,
in the
I agree.
Air.
Time travel and keeping track of everybody's miraculous gifts, so you're not discombobulated in the wrong way when you're seeing, so that one's fire and this one's wind, and you feel like you're playing the Japanese card game Avatar all over again.
You're onto something there, because they become reduced to their gifts.
That's
something that didn't strike me. But as you say it, they're not, and I don't know how they could do this. I think Avengers handles it well, but they're not fully developed beyond their gifts, aside from maybe three or four main people in this film.
Right. Mac, who are you talking about? We're talking about McAvoy, Michael Fassbender, basically the biggest, most interesting stars we have.
Hugh Jackman.
Jennifer Lawrence.
And Jennifer Lawrence are probably the ones who get the most screen time.
Yeah, and I think at this point in the franchise, Josh, I think the director, Bryan Singer, and his arsenal of effects teams, they feel quite free to just turn this into an almost abstract series of images. And it's a juggling act, you know, which is interesting to watch. And if you're really into this mythology, it's stimulating just to see, okay, we're going from 1973 France to the U.S. to there's scenes in China, there's scenes in Paris, everywhere. And there's a little something for everybody, of course, which is the throw it against the wall, you know, method of trying to engage an audience. That's fine. I guess I found myself leaning into the 1970s scenes in D.C. where we have Nixon in a fairly tense kind of hostage crisis situation dealing with the mutants, and Peter Dinklage is there as the sniveling scientist who's created this super team of miserable RoboCops that are going to destroy us all. And just watching that play out, you do find yourself less frustrated. I did anyway, in that those scenes are allowed to play out at greater length. You're not always hopscotching over to some other plot line. And I think that does satisfy some sort of need in all of us, whether we're invested in this stuff or not, just to kind of let the thing play out rather than zip over to track 9 or zip over to track 4. And this was kind of my issue with even a movie as different from this as Cloud Atlas. Did you guys talk about that? I mean, the idea, the frustration level of always having to kind of hop over to the other four storylines, as easy and as graceful as that can be dealing with a piece of prose or a really well-developed novel, that is five times trickier in the movies. And I think that's why Singer's film here feels, you know, like a fairly good effort that, yes, will certainly conquer the global box office. And you're getting a look in the opening sequence at all the markets they're really concerned about with this film. China, there's a scene, China, there's the, you know, USSR, everything. You know, the American box office is almost incidental to a film like this. And I'm not sure how I feel about that, frankly.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello. Thank you for coming. With this weapon, there will be no human collateral damage. If I turn it on, the system couldn't even activate in here. Unless there's a mutant.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson, here with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, and we are reviewing the latest X-Men movie, X-Men Days of Future Past. So you're talking about the filmmaking there, what Singer and his team brings to it. And I have to say, that's maybe one of the elements. I know he didn't direct all of these films, but it's one of the elements of the franchise as a whole that leaves me wanting, is that there is no distinguishing characteristic in terms of the filmmaking, in terms of the visuals even. It just doesn't have any sort of zip or personality I can identify as an X-Men movie. And when I think about what has long been the strength of the franchise for me are the performers. They really have to work to squeeze this sort of personality out of their individual scenes on their own. I can't think of many instances where, say, the camera work or the dialogue or the direction do that in assistance with them, help them
exactly.
out. It's all on their shoulders.
We're talking about an almost egregious amount of digital effects going on. And I do think that there's – what I'm waiting for, Josh, is a movie – one of these movies – and I hate to lump them all into the same pot – but one of these big-budget superhero franchises is going to discover the next great digital effects house, the designers that could actually give you a new sight, a new kind of astonishment, rather than just the same old fireballs, you know, everything. It's all. I wish I had a better way of describing the sameness to this sort of effects. But you know, a lot of people are kind of that's this is what's kind of leading to a lot of people thinking, yeah, this one's okay. Mm-hmm. That's you're hearing that more than you should, I think,
because
this.
They frequently end in these fireballs, the same fireballs. Even one that I liked quite a bit, Captain America: The Winter Soldier, ends that way.
Right.
Here we get a dual ending because of the time frames going on, and we have action taking place in two different eras. Mm-hmm. We get double the chaotic fireball ending.
Right,
and for me, it was just, instead of heightening the tension, it was doubly exhausting.
Right.
But I do want to go back to the cast a little bit, because I think they are a strength here, especially Fassbender and McAvoy almost make this worth watching in my mind because of what they're able to do in their individual scenes. They're both playing ideological opposites, so the roles are right there for them. McAvoy being Professor X, who has this hope in humanity, yet being able to work with mutants, and Fassbender as Magneto, who just wants to take over the world, has no hope at all that humans will ever be able to do anything but be fearful for mutants. So they have these opposing viewpoints that work well. I like how they give faces to that ideology. But I think Jackman is crucial to this series. And even as the acting has gotten tonier, so we have all this British professionalism, right? We've got Fassbender and McAvoy, and we've got Stewart, and we've got Ian McKellen as the older Magneto. And Jackman is thrown into that. So he knocks about almost like a blunt tool compared to the styles that they have. And there's a really good scene. My favorite scene in Days of Future Past actually is maybe 10 seconds. Mm. It's in an airplane where Jackman's Wolverine is talking to Fassbender's Magneto. And Magneto says something, I take it we're fast friends in the future, because they're certainly not at this point. And the way their two styles play off each other, to me, it seemed this great example of star charisma going up against impeccable acting talent.
I think
of actors that way. It's not fair. They have a little bit of each, but I think of Jackman as being more star.
Yeah.
Fassbender is more actor.
Right.
And they go, those two styles go up against each other, and it's a delightful draw how that scene ends.
Well, okay, and the 10 seconds you're talking about, maybe it's 30, who knows, but correct me if I'm wrong, that's a sequence that is as simple as two people in a set.
They're
talking.
Just in an airplane.
Yeah,
you're
and
right.
There's not, and there's maybe this is the key to the success or the failure of any of these films are the scenes that simply take it easy, let two or more of the actors sit and talk. Either they're dealing with necessary exposition or hopefully something more interesting. Is it where you start checking out or where you start checking in?
Mm.
And I think in this film, you can look at similar scenes in Days of Future Past where Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen are sharing sequences. And, of course, McKellen knows an awful lot from the Lord of the Rings trilogy, how to give just the right panache to some of the most expedient and just functional dialogue. And I think, if anything, he probably studied up on how Alec Guinness worked his way through the first Star Wars, just to kind of give just enough of a sense of humor to kind of keep you in there. But, yeah, I don't have any aversion to special effects, to the digital array of possibilities now. It's just that what I keep coming back to, I guess, is just because everything is possible with digital effects doesn't mean everything is advisable. And I even a director of medium to medium pretty good talent like Bryan Singer, I think, abdicates his responsibility a little bit in just turning over reams of imagery and storytelling to, you know, kind of a fast, really quickly intercut series of just visual sort of splashes. And I don't know. I you go in and out in a movie like this. You sort of beam on and off, I think.
It's a matter of simplicity, too, when it comes to the special effects, because it doesn't work for me when it gets amplified, as these climaxes do that we talked about. But if you go back to that scene where there's the conversation between Wolverine and Magneto, it's interesting how a minute or two before, there is a special effect employed. Magneto is getting angrier, and his power is to be able to control metal, bend metal. And we see as his anger seethes, the whole plane starts to crumple in on itself. And this is just, it's not that elaborate in
right.
terms of special effects, at least compared to what usually
no,
goes
on. No, it's a good
on.
Example. It's a good example.
And it's only one thing happening, and it doesn't involve, all that much technology or different characters. But that is probably the most effective special effect in the film to me, and it comes down to a matter of simplicity.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And I think what we're learning is that when you look at the Chinese film market, which is a huge percentage of any film like this, you know, where they can make their money globally, bigger really is better. And they haven't yet, as a ticket buying mass, haven't experienced the same satiation point, I think, that maybe you and I have about enough already with this particular look or this sort of onslaught of effects. I think it's also one of the reasons that somebody like Edgar Wright, the director I was so excited was going to do Ant-Man, right?
Right.
I mean, this is the Paul Rudd vehicle, another Marvel franchise, hopefully, in the making. And I was enthused about seeing Ant-Man because you think, oh, great, we have a director with an actual sense of humor from Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz doing this kind of thing. We might actually get a blockbuster superhero franchise, you know, with some personality and wit. Well, they bounced him because I think there was a question about, the competing visions. Is he going to really deliver the kind of effects-driven, straight-ahead action picture that's going to work in every foreign market? Or is there going to be a lot of sort of English language-specific in-jokes and asides that, you know, frankly, I wouldn't mind at this point? So maybe I'm turning into kind of a chauvinist about it, or you know, maybe a cultural isolationist. I want something that won't necessarily travel, you know. But I don't know. These are all meant to travel as far as they can and as widely as they can. But I fear, Josh, that even good directors just kind of turn over a lot of these movies to what used to be known as the second unit, you know, and now, of course, is the digital effects unit. And this is why they're all looking the same after a while.
Well, X-Men Days of Future Past is currently out in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with Michael and my take on it, email us. That's at feedback@filmspotting.net. We would also love to get a voicemail. It's been a little while since we've played one here on the show. So leave us a voicemail with your review of X-Men at 312-264-0744. Of course, you can find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting. Well, it's the end of May, Michael, which means I once again have to live vicariously through you as I ask you about your annual trip to the Cannes Film Festival. Then a bit more X-Men talk as we reveal the results of the most recent film spotting poll question. Which next movie from an X-Men star are you anticipating the most? Stay with us.
We are all shapeshifters. We are all lonely drifters. And forgotten hours when we escape through the winking eyes and the secret handshake.
Brief interruption here where we want to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. With Adam away, it was my turn to spend some time on Shutterstock looking at their collections, which wasn't a problem. I'm there all the time for the day job anyway. So I did find a couple of interesting videos tied to this week's theme, movie teams, because we're reviewing X-Men Days of Future Past. So started with teams, put that into the search field, came up with 35,310 videos, Michael, including the one I would have expected of people putting their hands together, you know, in a huddle before they break apart, kind of like what you, Adam, and I do before recording every show. You know,
that's right.
Also put in mutants there. That only gave me 54 results, including one of a woman dressed up as a Jedi warrior and as a Star Wars fan. I find that a little bit insulting, but I'm sure I'll get over it. Whether those are the video clips you're looking for or something else, Shutterstock does have over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations. They also have 3D motion graphics. The clips come in a variety of digital formats. Most come in high definition and now 4K.
Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy. Shutterstock has sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. No credit card is needed. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Save the video selections you find to your clip box. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM514, and new accounts will receive 20% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off new accounts, use offer code FILM514. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
We have a choice in this world about how to tell sad stories. On the one hand, you can sugarcoat it. And nothing is too messed up that can't be fixed with a Peter Gabriel song. I like that version as much as the next girl does. It's just not the truth.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. That's Shailene Woodley from the trailer for The Fault in Our Stars. The movie, which opens next weekend, is an adaptation of a popular young adult novel. But unlike recent YA adaptations, Twilight or Hunger Games or this year's Divergent, which also starred Woodley, Fault's teen protagonists aren't fantastic creatures or sci-fi saviors. They're just heroically trying to survive terminal illness. In advance of our planned review of Fault in a couple of weeks, our poll question this week has us doing some informal and completely unreliable demographic research. Who among you reads? My wife, the librarian, is curious. Before we get to that, though, a couple of quick notes here. Michael, we were just talking off air about the Film Spotting live show, which we were eagerly anticipating your participation in when it comes here July 26th, 9:30 p.m. at the Music Box Theater.
Right.
Apparently, we had yet to check with you about that date, though. So
no, that's true.
Does July 26th at the Music Box Theater work?
I'm damn glad it wasn't the following Saturday, because that's Lollapalooza, and my son, the rocker, who's now the skateboarding rocker.
Awesome.
We got plans.
Okay, yeah. Good.
But no, I'd love to. Love to.
The 26th is available.
I will be there.
All right. Well, now we can definitely sell you as part of that show. We're looking forward to it. Plans are coming together. Just a little bit of ways here. You can get your tickets now for that. We will link to it in the show notes. Bonus content this week. It's going to come off last week's top five, which was one of our most unusual and personal top five lists ever. We did our top five movie tattoos that we would get. So these are the movie-related tattoos we would at least think about getting, or at least think about listening for a top five anyway. Now, in advance of that, we got a bunch of great examples from listeners, and you can see those over at producer Sam Van Halgren's Tumblr page. We'll link to that in the show notes as well. For bonus, then, this week, we're going to get, Michael, your movie-related tattoo that you would get, or that you have, or that you're getting right now. Is it being inked as we sit here? By the end of the show, you'll have it for us.
Yes, I will. I will. I will.
Okay.
Yes, got it.
We'll get to that in bonus. But now, Michael, whisk us away to the sunny coast of France and tell us about your stay at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Let me guess, that tattoo, it's going to be just the name of Nuri Bilge Ceylan. Put across your chest.
Very good.
Isn't it?
Beautifully pronounced, too.
Was that right?
Yes.
Okay.
That is the name and the pronunciation of the Turkish auteur, the master who won finally the Palme d'Or.
Yes.
That has eluded him for all these years.
Well deserved. I know he is a favorite.
I love this guy, and not all his films equally, but this latest film is called Winter Sleep, which, of course, sounds like a parody of an art house title when you talk about a film that is 3 hours and 16 minutes long.
Kind of like one of his earlier films, Distant.
Distant, yeah.
That title describes it a little bit.
Climates, my very favorite of his, does not have a great English language translation in the ring there, but he's always been indebted to Anton Chekhov, either indirectly or directly. And this is a story that's kind of taken from more expressly from a couple of different Chekhov short stories, one called The Bride. And it's set in the Anatolia region of Turkey. And the idea is that you have this hotel owner, a very wealthy, prosperous ex-actor, and his younger wife are living in not splendid isolation, but more like frustrated isolation out in this region. And the movie's a series of confrontations and relationships between these two characters, the actor's sister, the tenants on his land who are living on the knife edge of poverty. It's a beautiful, sad, funny, tragic, comic film. Just like everything, you always hear those kind of adjectival pileups when you hear people talking about Chekhov. And this is truly, to the degree it is a Chekhov adaptation, it's the best one I've ever seen.
Wow.
And I just love it. It's not for everybody. A lot of people liked other films at the Cannes Film Festival this year better, but I guess just to see a director doggedly kind of pursuing his own themes, working in this case with a script that he co-wrote with his wife, Ebru Ceylan, who was his co-star in the film Climates, it's really something to see. I wouldn't, for people who are new to Ceylan, Josh, and that's basically everybody in the U.S., I wouldn't necessarily recommend starting with this one, Winter Sleep, or the previous one, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. They're both wonderful, but they're forbidding. I would really try Climates first because it's a human scale length. It runs under 2 hours, and it's just a fascinating end of the relationship sort of story. And more than any other film I've ever seen, I've never seen a film focusing in Climates so clearly on what happens after the end of a relationship between the same two people. So that's the place to start with this guy.
Well, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, a little more entertainingly titled there. That one is a favorite yeah. of ours here on Film Spotting. Both Adam and I really, really love that film. So Ceylan did win the Palme d'Or.
Won the big prize.
A couple of the other prize winners here. We have Best Director went to Bennett Miller,
yep.
American Director for Foxcatcher. The Best Screenplay Award went to Leviathan, not The Leviathan that I love so much from last year, but a different film. Best First Feature went to a film called Party Girl. And the Actor and Actress Awards, Timothy Spall won the Best Actor for Mr. Turner, and Julianne Moore won Best Actress for Maps to the Stars.
Yeah.
So aside from the J-Lon, which you really would recommend, it sounds like, if not for a first-time viewing of his works, what else that you saw? Let's think about it this way. As those of us who didn't get to go,
yep.
we sort of map out our viewing schedule, at least I do, depending on what's been talked about at Cannes. And some of these are titles I heard about before, and afterwards maybe they will rise or fall on how soon I want to see them as they start to come out around the country.
Sure.
Is there a title or two people should definitely put on their calendars now? And maybe is there a title or two that you might want to reconsider after what you've seen?
I mean, a lot of the stuff that Sony Pictures Classics has picked up for distribution or has been behind from the beginning, Sony's by far the biggest, most aggressive player in this game, and they're tough competitors. Music, you know, there's plenty of other players in the international distribution game, including our own Music Box Films. But Sony picked up Mr. Turner. They've been behind Foxcatcher, the Bennett Miller film, from the beginning, and that's taken a long time to get to the editing, through the editing phase to what we have now. And this is about the true crime saga of the billionaire John DuPont, who financed his own training facility for the U.S. Olympic wrestling team. And his obsession with this particular pet project ended up in murder eventually. The film co-stars Channing Tatum and Mark Ruffalo. And I love Bennett Miller's stuff. I'm not quite sure what I think about this one yet, Josh, but it's already kind of being positioned and is going to get a big pop, I think, for awards consideration in the fall season. Steve Carell is almost unrecognizable as DuPont, and not just because he's got an enormous prosthetic beak, you know, but and his nickname was, in fact, the Eagle in real life. But it's a very that was a good pick. You know, I was less thrilled with the film than others, but it got an amazingly good critical ride over there. And there's something about the way Bennett Miller has handled this material that particularly entranced the British press. They really thought it was like a state of the American soul movie, like a major work. And, you know, when I see it again in 3 months, I may have a very different reaction.
Sure.
Or at least a somewhat different reaction.
Still wrestling over that one. Any that were a bit of a letdown, at least, compared to what you were expecting going in?
A film that I found myself almost completely at odds with many, many of the critical responses to was a Hungarian film called White God, which is a little bit like Hitchcock's The Birds, but also kind of snuck inside maybe Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, where it's basically a story, a heartwarming tale of a girl and her dog separated by her cruel father, and they have to find each other again. Turns into the story of like wild dog packs massing together, forming an army, and attacking their human tormentors.
Oh my!
So it's like all films are manipulative, Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Some films really feel like they're just jerking you around. And at this one, maybe I'm too much of a dog guy. You know, I am. I love dogs. You know, and there's certain things about it that appeal to all kinds of folks. Manolo Dargis and The Times really flip for it. That one I'm going to have to give one more look to because, I don't know, by day 10 too, Josh, when you're over there, you're kind of reviewing your own biorhythms.
Yes, I believe it. Yeah.
You're not reviewing the films anymore.
Do you have an idea what the film count was that you managed to squeeze in?
It's actually a little less every year when I started going to Cannes.
You probably learned to be selective and how to pace yourself.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, I got to see 4 or 5 a day.
Sure.
I got to see the 8:30 in the morning and the midnight. And, you know, by day 5, you're just, you know, you're committing crimes. I mean, you're not responsible for your own actions. But the other film that I really think people should look out for is another one that Sony Pictures Classics picked up, a Russian drama called Leviathan that won the Screenplay Award. Many people thought it could and should have won the Palme. And it's a wonderful tale of just, you know, one marriage, a guy living, an auto mechanic living on the edge of this fishing village in the middle of nowhere. But the mayor of this corrupt little town wants the land for a building project, and he basically kicks him off it. And it's all about how this guy tries to fight this system. And it's a series of unfortunate events for this family. But that's a really rich, compelling film, and it's almost as you get so many different layers and perspectives on corruption. It's like a mini Russian version of The Wire. And it's wonderful. It's really good.
Well, I'm sure there were a number of other titles you did cover in your coverage for the Tribune. That's where listeners can find more. That's chicagotribune.com/movies.
Yeah, you can also check chicagotribune.com/talking pictures. We did a lot of video this year too,
and excellent,
you know, including I went to the very first Steak and Shake opening in France, you know, 2 blocks from the Palais. made, well, first of all, yes.
Did they do it right? Is it just as good as here?
$21 American, though, for a burger, fries, and a shake. $21.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be one of those ugly Americans complaining about the euro conversion, you know, rate. But
best to stay out of the steak and shake.
Yeah,
then.
yeah. But it was good.
All right. Well, we'll link to Michael's coverage of the Cannes Film Festival as well in the show notes at filmspotting.net.
How did you lose them? The treatment for my spine affects my DNA.
You sacrificed your power so you could walk.
What do you know about it?
I've lost my fair share.
Huh. Dry your eyes, Eric. It doesn't justify what you've done.
You've no idea what I've done.
I know. As we've already discussed, Michael, maybe two of the only reasons to see X-Men Days of Future Past there, Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy engaging in some hostilities there in that clip from the new X-Men. A couple of weeks ago, we pitted the two actors against each other, along with a couple of their fellow mutants, in this poll question. Which X-Men's next non-mutant movie are you most excited for? Here were the options we gave people. Hugh Jackman, who will be in Chappie from director Neil Blomkamp. James McAvoy will be starring in Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. Michael Fassbender in Frank. Jennifer Lawrence will be wrapping up the Hunger Games trilogy with Mockingjay. And then we gave this option as well. All Mutants Must Die. In other words, these movies all sound horrible. Michael, how did it come out?
Okay, we have Hugh Jackman in Chappie, 5%.
Last place.
All Mutants Must Die. These movies all sound horrible. 9%. That's lower than I would have guessed.
Wow, Hugh followed.
You got a lot
All Mutants Must Die.
You got a lot of true believers out there. That's good. James McAvoy, Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, 22%. Jennifer Lawrence, Hunger Games, the first part of the There's two Mockingjay wrap ups here. So
that's
the
right.
First
they're
one.
Splitting up.
And 23%. And the winner, maybe not surprisingly, because Adam's love for the Fassbender is very famous. Michael Fassbender, Frank, 39%.
Not surprising. At all. We heard from Steve Yosaro in Albuquerque, who spoke for most all of the listeners when he said this, Fassbender, Fassbender, Fassbender. And he goes on in that manner for quite a while.
Kay Maynor says, sure, we don't get to see Fassbender's glorious face in the film, but those few shots of him in that skimpy tank top, more than enough to make up for it and have it be my pick.
That's obviously Adam writing in under an assumed name.
The Fassbender appeals to a wide range of the demographics here. But, you know, and the other thing, honestly, Josh, is he truly is such a commanding actor. He's got just enough of a sense of humor to kind of let you know that he's not like William Shatnering his way through it. And, you know, he really is one of the reasons this X-Men sequel, I think, is you know, holds up at all.
Well, we did hear from someone who made a non-Fassbender vote. That would be Josh from Farmington, Connecticut. After the awful, awful, awful Elysium, he says, my anticipation for Chappie has sunk deeper than I previously thought possible. That would be the Jackman film. I've enjoyed both Hunger Games films, and Frank looks like a lot of fun, but nothing excites me more than an experimental release structure. So my vote goes to Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby. Two 90-minute films that tell the same story from different perspectives, plus another two-hour film that combines the two, say no more, I'm in. That brings us to this week's poll, which has to do with The Fault in Our Stars. That's coming out next weekend, and it stars Shailene Woodley along with Laura Dern, Willem Dafoe, and Mike Birbiglia. The screenplay is by the pair of screenwriters who handled last year's The Spectacular Now, which made it onto my top 10 list, so a very good reason I'm looking forward to this film. The movie is based on the best-selling 2012 book by YA author John Green, which is not only best-selling, but I know very well received by critics too. So our question has to do about the book. Complete this phrase for next week's Film Spotting poll. The novel, The Fault in Our Stars.
Okay, here they are. I read it and loved it. I read it and meh. My kid read it. I've heard of it. And what's a book?
So
those are your five.
Dating yourself there, maybe, if you choose My Kid Read It, but I might be quickly approaching that category. We do want to hear what your relationship is with the novel, The Fault in Our Stars. So do head over to filmspotting.net and cast your vote. All right. Even though we're short one member of the Film Spotting team, Michael, with Adam away, you and I will still band together to share our lists of the best teams from the movies. It's too bad, though, because I'd love to hear Adam defend his unending love for the Three Amigos. Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
We're all in this. phenomenon that goes on and on. Saying it right, but you're doing it wrong. Slow down, you're going too fast now.
Hi, this is Matthew Vaughn. I am the director of Stardust, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
We're going to be using aliases on this job. Under no circumstances do I want any one of you to relate to each other by your Christian names. And I don't want any talk about yourself personally. That includes where you've been, your wife's name, where you might have done time, or a bank maybe you robbed in, say, Petersburg. All I want you guys to talk about, if you have to, is what you're gonna do. That should do it. Here are your names. Mr. Brown.
That's Lawrence Tierney in Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, as good a place as any to start this week's top five movie teams. Do you mind, Michael, if I refer to you as Mr. Pink
for the rest of the show? I'm dressed like him, so I'm all set to go.
Good. Over the course of nine films, Tarantino has assembled a few memorable movie teams. You have Kill Bill's team of assassins, the eight soldiers hunting Nazi scalp in Inglourious Basterds, and even the trio of women in Death Proof. They could qualify as a movie team as well. None of those, however, will be making our top five list, so we wanted to give Tarantino a bit of a nod here at the start. One restriction we did put on this list right away was we didn't want to do sports teams, kind of its own category, even though when you Google movie teams, that's what comes up first. A lot of good options there, probably its own separate list. So we didn't consider those. Did you restrict yourself in any other ways, Michael, when you were thinking about this?
I could only put Remember the Titans on three of the five. Okay. So I ignored. No,
some discipline you have there.
No, that's the same deal. I mean, it depends how you define teams, too, because a lot of the films I'm most attracted to are kind of unwilling or maybe wary, reluctant people thrown together to make some sort of a makeshift team just to kind of get through whatever the project at hand is. So that's to me, that's more dramatically intriguing.
Yeah, and so they didn't have to be an institutional team of some sort.
Right.
Yeah, I thought of it a little more vaguely as well. This is a group of people who are brought together or come together for a common goal or a common purpose.
Right.
So loose there for me too. So with all of that in mind, let's jump in. What's your number five, Michael?
So many of the great Hollywood directors, Josh, deal with this very premise, the idea of kind of typically men in a very high-pressure situation, sort of trying to make do the best they can with disparate members of a team. And one of my very favorites is Only Angels Have Wings from Howard Hawks, 1939. This is the one where Cary Grant plays the pilot for a mail service that's flying mail runs, really dangerous mail runs, from a fictional South American town of Barranca through a high pass in the Andes. And this is about the most dangerous flying you can do on the planet. And you have all kinds of interesting characters kind of bashing around in the same tiny little setting. It's a great cast. You have people like Thomas Mitchell, who won an Oscar that year for Stagecoach, playing the mechanic. You have Rita Hayworth showing up as one of the guests of the, you know, one of the visitors to this group. And also Jean Arthur plays a showgirl that just kind of gets airdropped into the plot. And it's just a wonderful study of all these different characters, many of whom have a very fatalistic attitude about just how dangerous their job is and how they really have to be forced to think of something beyond their own dire circumstances. And I, it's not a film that's, of all the great films that came out in 39, Josh, it's strange to me how many of them actually deal with this idea of makeshift teams being formed from the very disparate group of people. You look at Stagecoach, I could have just as easily chosen Stagecoach.
Yeah.
And then, in fact, my number one pick, same thing. But Only Angels Have Wings is one of my very favorites of Hawks, and I just think as a portrait of kind of male camaraderie and competition under extreme duress, and, you know, with a sense of humor, a light touch, but it's essentially a really suspenseful human story. I love it. And if people don't know it, they should see it.
A little tease there for your number one. I think I know where you're going with that 1939 year. My number five, a bit more recent, comes from 1970. It's Le Cercle Rouge. This is the heist film from Jean-Pierre Melville. Features three of Melville's taciturn male types who team up to rob a jewelry store. You have the debonair thief just out of prison, played by Alain Delon. You have the criminal who's escaped from custody, played by Gian Maria Volante. And then you have an alcoholic ex-cop who's played by Yves Montand. Now, this being Melville, this team communicates mostly through silent stares at each other, masculine gestures, and their wardrobe, too. I mean, a lot is said in this movie by how you wear your hat or don't wear your hat. Right. And as far as the teamwork goes, the movie itself opens with this quote, which is attributed to Buddha. Others have said Melville made it up. When men, even unknowingly, are to meet one day, whatever may befall each, whatever their divergent paths, on the said day, they will inevitably come together in the red circle. So this speaks to the sense of fatalism that I think drives Melville's crime films, but it also has this idea of it of a group destined to come together for a common quest.
That's a great pick, and I think that quote is basically the same thing as the Coen brothers' first title card in Fargo. This is based on a true story, which of course it wasn't.
Right.
That's a great pick because it links up to all these other particularly French films like Rafifi back in the mid-50s, where it's always about very kind of cool, considered atmosphere around some sort of heist.
Yeah.
And that is a wonderful way to get to study, again, typically male camaraderie and competition under extremely tense circumstances. And with the right director, it's more than just a heist movie.
Yeah, because even though it's a common crime, it's given the demeanor of the quest. And I think that's what
Melville
does here.
Common for you. I've never pulled one off. Yeah. I've attempted a couple.
Every other weekend, it's what I do. In Le Cercle Rouge, I like how the quest, it gets this mythic sense because of the timing of the movie, really, because this is a 140-minute film, and I think about 30 minutes, the last 30 minutes pretty much, are devoted to the heist itself. So that alone elevates it in our minds, and it really is a reverse set piece, that heist. So forgiving this idea of teamwork and existential purpose, I'm making Le Cercle Rouge my number 5.
That's great. Good pick.
What do you got for number 4?
This starts out as one desperate guy's project. This is The Naked Spur, 1953. It's my favorite, I think, of the James Stewart, Anthony Mann Westerns. It was also one of the very first Westerns, Josh, that for me got over my initial kind of resistance or reluctance to embracing the genre. I didn't grow up with, I've said this before, but I didn't grow up loving Westerns. It took me a long time to find the ones that even though I admired many of them and was impressed by a lot of them for a lot of reasons, it took me a while to really find the ones I loved. And they tend to be these somewhat smaller, seriously location-bound ones, that are truly, you feel like you got the hell out of the studio. So the Stewart character is a solo act, but through circumstances the plot throws at him, we have him being kind of somewhat reluctantly joining up with a couple of other characters. Millard Mitchell plays an old prospector who offers him $20 to help out. Then they in turn run into a Union soldier played by Ralph Meeker, who's been discharged. Robert Ryan is really remarkable as the psychological genius who's always pitting one of the members of this little posse against the other. And Janet Leigh's also in the picture as Ryan's companion who really has eyes for Stewart and vice versa. I like this film a tremendous amount, Josh, just because it goes from one driven, obsessive guy's story to kind of just how he's forced to rethink, what it means to even trust anybody, because he does not know who to trust in the scenario. He doesn't know if Meeker's a trustworthy character, the Union soldier. He doesn't know, half the time the characters in the film don't know whether who's sane and who's insane in this scenario. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I think I've always appreciated how this film introduced me into a kind of Western I really do love, and a lot of it's based on this idea of a solo act, a rugged individualist, the Stewart character, I think, being broken down into a more human guy and just realizing that he's not alone and he has to rely on other people.
I'm taking him back and I'm going to do it alone. You didn't catch him alone. You was going round and round until you run into me.
You were hired to do a job and you were paid for it.
You ain't going to buy my claim in this for no $20. What about him? He done the climbing, didn't he?
Could have gotten killed, too. Tell you what, I'll settle for a third. How about you, Jesse? Share and share alike?
That's the way it is. Unless you're of a mind to kill us all.
Looks like you got yourself a couple of partners, Howie.
Ah, quit acting like we was friends.
Well, I've got a Western for my list, too. I'm not going to get to it just yet, though.
Okay.
I'll get to it soon. Instead, my number four.
Is it Dirty Dingus McGee with Frank Sinatra?
No, I did consider it, though.
Okay.
No, my number four has a team in the title. And no, it's not the A-Team. Instead, it's Team America, World Police. This is Trey Parker and Matt Stone's really filthy marionette movie musical, action musical. And, you know, beyond that description, do I have to make the case why it's a great film? That should really cover it. It was, after all, my number seven movie of 2004. The team of the title is this paramilitary anti-terrorism force. They have a secret base located inside Mount Rushmore. They're led by a no-nonsense commander and, as well, a supercomputer. The team includes Lisa, who's a psychologist, Carson, her love interest, Sarah, supposedly a psychic, Joe the jock, and Chris, the martial arts expert. Drama ensues when they get a new member of the team, however, new recruit Gary. Now, his special skill is acting. That's what he brings to the table. Keep in mind, yes, these are all marionette puppets. Now, the joke is that despite this aesthetic, this look, Team America proceeds as if it were a Michael Bay budgeted Hollywood blockbuster action movie. I mean, you see cities being destroyed because of the carelessness of their mission and their actions. There are plenty of inane, inspirational speeches that are given. And the movie even pauses for that random, elaborately choreographed sex scene that we get in a lot of the ridiculous action movies.
Right.
So overall, this is, you know, really a wonderful spoof of your standard Hollywood action movie, only with puppets and great original songs.
All right, team, that's it. We've got a job to do. Let's go police the world.
America, America.
There's also a fair amount of foreign policy critique going on here when you look at what some of these speeches are about. And the team itself really is a symbol for aggressive American interventionism. So it does eviscerate the pervasive sort of jingoism that erupted in the wake of 9/11, this coming out in 2004. But at the same time, what's interesting about this movie, and Parker and Stone have talked about this too, is that it does recognize that the world looks to the U.S. to play cop at times, to be the world police. So you think about calls for involvement in Syria recently, or even something like the Bring Back Our Girls campaign in Nigeria. So the movie struggles with this image America has as itself and maybe the rightness or the expectations of some parts of the world because of that image. So both of these strands, the cynicism and the patriotism, they come together in this outrageously crude speech that Gary gives on behalf of his team. And we couldn't even play it here if we bleeped it. There wouldn't be much left. So
now do you tell me this. I know people who write this movie off completely because they just think it's basically, you know, mean-spirited and in their view, you know, right-wing, you know, it just kind of nastiness.
It can completely be read that way. But I think you'd have to discount some of the other jabs that are being made as well. I think this is why Parker and Stone are such polarizing figures, is they don't take a side. And, you know, whatever side you're on, if they're not on yours and that given joke, then you're going to be against them. But if you're willing to take the hits along with the jokes that you like, then they can do some pretty brilliant stuff. So I think Team America counts as that. It's my number four. Really, if you haven't seen a big screen marionette musical lately, this this should be the one. How about your number four, Michael?
Okay, I attempted by all kinds of 60s movies that are really more just affirmatively about a team, some sort of team organization getting stuff done. The Magnificent Seven, which I would probably, in a different day, you know, throw in there just for the Elmer Bernstein theme alone.
Mm-hmm.
The Great Escape, the John Sturges film, which I you know, obviously got a huge fan base and I love too. Again, thank you, Elmer Bernstein, for writing a fantastic theme. I've never been much for the Dirty Dozen, I admit it. You know, to me, that was sort of the beginning of a new, really sadistic wave of action picture that despite the fact I love a lot of the actors, including especially Lee Marvin, that film does not live in my affections. But you know what? I'm going to throw them all away for a movie that's got nothing to do with that, Jaws.
What's that one?
What?
That one there, on your arm.
Oh, well, it's a tattoo. I got that removed.
Don't tell me. Mother.
What is it?
What?
Mr. Hooper, that's the USS Indianapolis.
I love Jaws. I love it's still my favorite Spielberg film.
So not an efficient team that's been trained together for years.
There's something, Josh, that I'm just drawn to this idea of these reluctant, kind of clashing people who have to figure out a way.
Three guys stuck on a boat is your kind of team.
When you're looking at Robert Shaw, Roy Scheider, and Richard Dreyfuss together, it is astonishing to me, Josh, that people at the time and now look at Jaws as kind of the beginning of a different, soulless, impersonal kind of blockbuster. And
they hadn't seen nothing yet.
I don't know. These characters to me are just, this is pop movie making with really great, kind of totally surfacey, but really wonderful, wonderfully written and acted characters. And I just love the fact that this three-person team is what it takes to get, you know, Shaw's sacrifice to the shark, and that's the only 5 seconds of this movie I don't really love, Josh, is where the shark is actually eating Robert Shaw, because that's when you know. Mechanics. The rest of it, so crafty, and the sparing use of the shark and all that. But, yeah, that's my favorite three-person team in modern thrillers, let's say.
Well, you're not going to get any complaints from me bringing up Jaws. I actually considered it and assumed it was in our pantheon, the list of films that Adam and I can't choose from because we love them so much and would mention them all the time. It's not there yet. So
really?
But I didn't put it on, so I'm
glad. Is it in the Parthenon? Did you put it in the Parthenon by accident?
It's waiting in the Parthenon to be moved into the Pantheon. Okay, yes, it's a very elaborate system we have here. You are listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson here with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips, and we're making lists of the top five movie teams tied to X-Men Days of Future Past with its superhero team. My number three is The Seven Samurai, really one of the greats from 1954, Akira Kurosawa. You mentioned The Magnificent Seven, which was inspired by The Seven Samurai, the 1960 film that I did consider. Instead, I went with Kurosawa's original version. And here, a team of samurai are hired to protect a village from bandits. Among the seven are the weary leader, played by Takashi Shimura, a young, eager warrior, played by Isao Kimura, and then you have the jokey clown figure who has a secret past and ends up proving to be one of the most valuable members of the team, played, of course, by Toshiro Mifune. Others on the team have crucial skills, too. You have one member who knows how to handle a bow, another handles a sword really well, and they are an imposing force. That's why they're hired by the villagers, yet they still struggle to repel these bandits. This isn't, you know, this heroic vision of these professionals coming in and just tromping on the bandits. So this movie is ultimately a mournful take on violence and revenge and loss. The lasting image for me from it is from that climactic battle in the rainstorm where the combatants are being consumed by mud as the fighting goes on and the mud thickens there. I think, like Le Cercle Rouge, this touches on the code of teamwork that lies behind the actions we're watching on the screen and about what it means to come together and see something difficult through. Mm-hmm. So for its team of warriors, Seven Samurai, that's my number three.
Okay, great. Great film. It's been hit with the label of classic or masterwork so often, Josh. I fear that people start tuning it out, and if they haven't seen it, they just end up not seeing it. But to see that is one beautifully paced long film that doesn't feel like a minute longer than it needs to be.
That's what I was just going
to
say. It's absolutely thrilling. You look at the running time maybe imposing and the fact that it is a 54 Japanese film, but there's no reason to feel that way about approaching this.
And Mifune's performance is just, every time you see it, it's so much bigger and crazier than you remember the last time. And yet it doesn't unbalance the picture. It's perfectly placed. Yeah, it's a wonderful film.
What do you have for your number two?
Well, I love the musicals, I love the Houston musical. And the whole idea of people coming together to make a show, that's sort of instantaneous, temporary teamwork. And then they all disperse and go on with their lives. But my favorite in this genre, I'm not going to pick a Mickey and Judy. I'm not going to do any of that. But Vincent Minnelli's The Bandwagon is a film I've managed to shoehorn into other discussions here. But this, I love this idea that the kind of somewhat passe screen hoofer played by Fred Astaire has to kind of reinvent himself as a Broadway showman in a more serious, high-minded type of musical up against a ballerina played by Sid Charisse, working for this insufferably pretentious director who's going to make played by Jack Buchanan. And of course, all those plans go to hell, and the show's a disaster out of town, and they have to kind of redo it again. But it's the simplest explanation, I think, why the movies, Josh, have always come back to this idea of what it takes to make a show. You go back to, the early talkies like Applause, and Broadway Melody, films like 42nd Street. This is it's life and death. A lot of jobs on the line. You got a month or two to put it together. And, you know, people fall in love, people fall out of love, people have heart attacks, people, whatever. And it's all there. And I love that notion of teamwork, because it's your job and your paycheck to kind of find a way to get along with these people. And I adore the film. And it's got true camaraderie on screen. And it's Minnelli's camera really knows how to capture a team in motion too, because he's wonderful at creating just evocative swirls of movement and different people kind of doing different things. And there's really been no better montages, I think, in cinema history that show the making of a show.
Everything that happens in life can happen in a show. You can make them laugh, you can make them cry. Anything can go. The clown with his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment.
Well, I knew I could count on you to bring Minnelli to the table.
Yes, so thank you.
The bandwagon, great pick. My number two is going to be my superhero team. That's the concept that inspired this top five with X-Men. And I figured that one of these would have to make the list. Instead of the X-Men, though, instead of the Avengers, I'm going to go with the family known as the Incredibles. You got Dad, Mr. Incredible, with his super strength. You have Mom, Helen, otherwise known as Elastigirl. Violet is their middle schooler who can become invisible. Then there's Dash, their super fast fourth grader, and Jack-Jack, the baby, whose powers we discovered later in the film. Director Brad Bird is, of course, interested in more than a superhero movie, though. He's really exploring the concept of the family unit here, and the family unit as a team, specifically. It's all about balancing your own desires with the needs of your family, right? When it comes to family life and recognizing how difficult that can be. That's where this movie is largely rooted in. It also, though, celebrates the rewarding sort of harmony that comes when everyone in the family is on the same page. These may be rare occasions, but it really is wonderful when it happens. The Incredibles also fits my theory that Pixar movies are for parents first. I think that's what makes them so good. They're not talking down to the youngest kids in their audience. They're talking up to the adults with the kids in mind. I think that applies here. So I like how there's a secondary team in this film. There's the family proper, but you also have Bob and Helen Parr, Mr. and Mrs. Incredible, who are perfectly voiced, of course, by Craig T. Nelson and Holly Hunter. So The Incredibles, on one level, is also very much about parenting as a team effort, too, and the challenge and rewards of
that's
that.
That's a great description of it. I think they're talking up to the parents, but they're not doing it just with lazy references to R-rated movies. You know,
right.
you go to like a really second-rate animation, like a Shark Tale or whatever, and
yep.
It's all just like Goodfellas jokes. And it's like, well, thanks for the half second of amusement that sort of undercuts your whole story.
Winking
right
at
there.
The parents, and then they think they got it covered. Yeah.
I think what you're saying, too, is the reason that people have such affection for the Toy Story trilogy, and that's a different kind of teamwork at illustrated there. But
oh, that could have easily applied for this list. Yeah, the toys and Toy Story.
But that's so many different animated films in particular, Josh, set out to do something like that. They create a world where a lot of different characters can eventually form a team, right?
Mm-hmm.
And come together for the common cause. And it can seem just like the most predictable hackneyed trope, until it's done beautifully, like it is in The Incredibles.
All right, that brings us to our number one movie teams. Michael, what landed in that slot for
you? All right. I know it's in your Parthenon. I'm sorry, your Pantheon.
Pantheon. At least get the terms.
Yeah, right. And it's not even a film I cherish above many, many, many others. But to me, the teamwork in The Wizard of Oz is some of the most miraculous casting ever in Hollywood. There's something about, Josh, something about the films that came out in 1939 that in retrospect now, with the historical perspective, when you look at what America was just on the brink of having to do and the kind of team effort they were about to embark on that cost so many lives. Only Angels Have Wings, my number five, was also 1939. But you know, I can't say anything new about The Wizard of Oz that people haven't either said or disagreed with in the past. But I think the simple fairy tale story of how the main characters in this, Dorothy, the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion, and the Scarecrow find what they need, you know, at the end of the rainbow, then I don't know. There's a reason that film is still debated. I think the most interesting debate to me actually is how heartwarming it really is. People are terrified by this movie.
Oh, yeah.
I know people who don't even understand why it's a perennial holiday favorite, a family favorite.
Uh-huh.
It's simply too psychologically disturbed. They had too many nightmares as kids, I think, because of that cyclical television viewing. But yeah, that's my favorite team, man.
So I may have missed it. Did you include Toto as part of the team?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
Good.
And Frank Morgan, you know, I mean, it's just great, interesting studio filmmaking. That film is much stranger and goes in weirder, more directions than you ever remember, you know, if you haven't seen it for a while. But I also just felt like I wanted, I think it's Judy Garland is such a strong and unsettling screen presence, even at that age. It sets a different tone than almost anybody else who would have been cast. I mean, it's terrifying to think of Shirley Temple, who was originally sort of earmarked for that role, as talented as Temple was. It needed somebody like Garland who kind of really made you invest immediately emotionally in what this team is after.
I think you're right. Unsettling is a word that probably could apply to the film overall. It's considered a family classic. That's how I grew up to watch it. But there are things there that will greatly disturb you,
yep.
No doubt.
Yep.
I think families would be more disturbed if they got together to watch my number one movie team, and that's The Wild Bunch. At one point in Sam Peckinpah's 1969 Western, a character looks at the title group, this bunch of thieves and rogues, and says, I think you all need a bath.
And that's right.
I can't do much better to describe this particular movie team. You do have William Holden as the leader. He's an aging cowboy who's hoping to make it on this one last run. There's this great bittersweet throwaway moment, really, where he struggles to get on his horse and some of the other guys chuckle about it. Of course, he manages to get up there and reestablish his authority. You also have his right-hand man, who's played by Ernest Borgnine. He gets a great sarcastic biting speech when the other suggests they pause to bury a comrade who's died while they're getting away.
Right,
Warren Oates and Ben Johnson are a pair of carousing brothers on this team. Jamie Sanchez is the Mexican member of the team whose ethnicity ruffles some feathers. And then you have Edmund O'Brien filling things out as, well, pretty much the crazy old coot is the role he's playing there. Now, like Le Cercle Rouge, the concept of teamwork is crucial to the movie's overall philosophy. I mean, nothing much matters to these guys, really, in this entire world, except this loose code of loyalty that they have for each other. Holden has a speech at one moment where he tells them, when they're starting to go after each other, about how they do have to stick together.
He's going to get us all killed. I'm going to get rid of
him. We're not getting rid of anybody. We're going to stick together just like it used to be. When you side with a man, you stay with him. And if you can't do that, you're like some animal. You're finished. We're finished. All of us.
The Wild Bunch is a rough film, really rough. There's jarring cruelty in it, potent, potent violence, even by today's standards. And it really does come very close to being nihilistic. But there's something in the bunch themselves that keeps the movie from going over the cliff. Unlike the hypocritical law that's on their trail, or this Mexican general who's supposed to be a figure of authority who's really up to all sorts of carousing and corrupting stuff, the bunch knows who they are and what they want. And even if it's bad, at least they're honest about that, about who they are and what they want. So they're honest to the world and they're honest to each other. So teamwork is both the movie's means and ends. And for that, The Wild Bunch is my number one.
That's a good pick. I think that film, it was such a cause celeb and such a controversial picture for so many decades, and I think it may have kind of lost the stars, kind of dimmed a little bit. And I think if you happen upon it just casually and you see certain things that Peckinpah was really into at the time, just this whole idea of the slow motion blood ballets,
yeah.
You know, where that
which has been parodied,
and I mean, I think I saw the Monty Python parody of that film called Salad Days, where it was like, did you ever see that? Where
no,
it's like,
no.
Hello, tennis, anyone? And then suddenly somebody throws a racket at somebody, and like there's a dismemberment and bleeding, and I remember it was just astonishingly funny and gory for television, but
playing off this idea, chaos and the bursts
but,
of violence.
But I think that film's got there's a lot that's kind of adolescent, and it's not mm-hmm. certainly not, it's patronizing at best toward the Mexicans and women and all the rest of it, but If you compare it to something like The Dirty Dozen, which was a huge success 2 years earlier, I think the violence in that film is just strictly for kicks. And it's a very efficiently made picture. Robert Aldrich did, you know, good work with the script he had. But I find that film is really just kind of disposable in some ways. And The Wild Bunch isn't. You can't shake that one as easily. I mean, the violence in The Wild Bunch is really intentionally much more disturbing and not ambiguous, but certainly contradictory in that you have early on, you have that really harsh scene of the kids who are just kind of watching, you know, with delight, this, you know, the ants and the scorpion. And, you know, it's an indictment, but it's not a celebration at the same time, but it's also an acceptance of what has to be done. And I mean, you look at it all kind of in the context of Vietnam and the carnage people were seeing every night on the evening news. That's the real overlay here, I think. And it's Holden's wonderful in it too, wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's complicated because it's a burst of movie it. It's one of these movies where you can't call it an indictment in violence or a celebration of violence because I don't know that it knows. And I think you can apply that as well to its treatment of women, which is certainly troubling overall when you look at how most of the female figures in the film are compliant pieces of property for the Bunch and others to pass around. Yet there are throwaway moments again that completely go against that. I think of the funeral of one of the women who is shot, that she's her body is carried through by other women through the dinner scene of all the men acting tough and at the end of their day. And it completely stops the scene dead in its tracks to kind of say, no, here's this woman who's been used, abused, and is now lost. And we should pause for that. So there are other touches that make you realize, I don't know that this is a statement of anything as much of a working through of a lot of troubling things.
Yeah. In fact, I don't even know if it's any less troubling than the enormous hit that year that was also a Western, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, a film that some people just would like to marry, essentially. They love it so much. But
there's a romanticism to that. Well,
yeah, and I find the glibness in that to be almost instantly dated.
Yeah.
And there's a very different quality, God knows, going on with The Wild Bunch. And, you know, that's a very good pick because it's teamwork, but at a price.
Butch and Sundance, another possible movie team. If you include two as a team, though, I kind of went for more. So that's why I didn't consider something like Butch and Sundance. How about any other honorable mentions that you did consider, though, Michael?
Well, I'm a total comedy nerd from the old days. So, I mean, you know, you guys have already proven your disdain and, you know, disinterest in even getting the facts right with the Marx Brothers.
Imagine that. The Marx Brothers didn't come to mind as a possible movie team. How did I forget them?
Abbott and Costello, I've always had the love-hate with because I love everything they do in the movies that basically came out of one of their stage routines. And I've always been less keen on sort of the more of the generic slapstick that a lot of the movies depend on. But the verbal patter routines in some of theirs, I think that's half of why I got interested in movies at age 8 or 10 the first time I saw those guys. So, yeah, I mean, those are more traditionally defined kind of movie teams that, you know, and it's not like that tradition is dead, Josh, now. I mean, well, even when you look at the kind of things we've had with Bill Murray and the times he worked with Harold Ramis, you know, whether behind the camera or on camera, that's in the same spirit of just kind of copacetic movie teams. And they always have to come out of some sort of team, some sort of ensemble, whether it's the Saturday Night Live cast or the SCTV cast. This is how you learn how to work with others and how you learn what your strengths are as a performer, maybe as a writer for yourself or for others. These things don't get created in a vacuum. And I think that's kind of what we're going for in the end here, Josh, is just this idea of what is the code? What are the rules for working together effectively in whatever this story is requiring of the characters?
Well, one reason I didn't consider comedy teams, aside from my massive underappreciation of the Marx Brothers, of course, is because we did comedy ensembles, top five comedy ensembles, not too long ago on the show here. So if you want to check that show out, it is number 388 in the archives. The honorable mentions I did consider, though, The Lady Killers with Alec Guinness and his gang of crooks. Thought about The Goonies, but that's one I want to revisit before I commit it to a top five quality. Have not seen it since I was a kid. Team Zsu, you know, that's a natural for me.
You're a love. You're a lover.
I did just also select that as one of my movie-related tattoos I would get, the Team Zsu logo. So couldn't go back there. Ghostbusters, likely Adam pick. if he had been doing this list, I think, possibly. The Fellowship of the Ring, that collection of hobbits and dwarves and wizards and elves. And one more here, Inception, Leonardo DiCaprio's dream teen. Those are our top five movie teams. Please send us your picks or any other comments you have about this week's show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail at 312-264-0744 or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
A couple of limited release openings here in Chicago we wanted to mention. American Jesus, a doc about Christianity in America, is playing at Facets. Over at the Gene Siskel Film Center, they have Black Box opening. This is from Chicago director Stephen Cohn. It's about a group of undergrads doing an adaptation of a 1980s young adult novel. Just a Sigh will also be playing there. That stars Gabriel Byrne. And Mana Kamana, this is from the producers of Leviathan from 2013, my favorite movie of that year. This time, it's a documentary about the people who make the journey via cable car to an ancient worship site in Nepal. In wide release this weekend will be Maleficent. This is Angelina Jolie as the Sleeping Beauty villain. And A Million Ways to Die in the West. This comes from writer-director, occasionally offensive Oscar host Seth MacFarlane. Next week, Adam will be back for our review of the so far critically adored The Immigrant. That's from director James Gray. Stars Joaquin Phoenix, Marion Cotillard, and Jeremy Renner. We're also going to do our top five movie immigrants. Sometimes you just got to roll with the obvious.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Music this week from the Sam Roberts Band. More information on the new album Low Fantasy at samrobertsband.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.